I too am a man like the rest of you. Let me live like a man and think of my soul and of God. As the sun and each atom of ether is a sphere complete in itself, and yet at the same time only a part of a whole too immense for man to comprehend, so each individual has within himself his own aims, and yet has them to serve a general purpose incomprehensible to man. A bee settling on a flower has stung a child, and the child is afraid of bees and declares that bees exist to sting people. A poet admires the bee sucking from the chalice of a flower and says it exists to suck the fragrance of flowers. A beekeeper, seeing the bee collect pollen from flowers and carry it to the hive, says that it exists to gather honey. Another beekeeper, who has studied the life of the hive more closely, says that the bee gathers pollen dust to feed the young bees and rear a queen, and that it exists to perpetuate its race. A botanist notices that the bee flying with the pollen of a male flower to a pistil fertilizes the latter and sees in this the purpose of the bee's existence. Another, observing the migration of plants, notices that the bee helps in this work and may say that in this lies the purpose of the bee. But the ultimate purpose of the bee is not exhausted by the first, the second, or any of the processes the human mind can discern. The higher the human intellect rises in the discovery of these purposes, the more obvious it becomes that the ultimate purpose is beyond our comprehension. All that is accessible to man is the relation of the life of the bee to other manifestations of life. And so it is with the purpose of historic characters and nations. Chapter 2. Death of old Count Rostov. Nicholas in retirement. His mother. His meeting with Princess Mary. Their wedding. Estate management in the country. Their family life. Sonia, a sterile flower. Denisov. Nicholas's name day. Natasha's wedding to Bezukhov, which took place in 1813, was the last happy event in the family of the old Rostovs. Count Ilya Rostov died that same year, and as always happens after the father's death, the family group broke up. The events of the previous year, the burning of Moscow and the flight from it, the death of Prince Andrew, Natasha's despair, Petya's death, and the old countess's grief, fell blow after blow on the old count's head. He seemed to be unable to understand the meaning of all these events, and bowed his old head in a spiritual sense, as if expecting and inviting further blows which would finish him. He seemed now frightened and distraught, and now unnaturally animated and enterprising. The arrangements for Natasha's marriage occupied him for a while. He ordered dinners and suppers, and obviously tried to appear cheerful, but his cheerfulness was not infectious as it used to be. On the contrary, it evoked the compassion of those who knew and liked him. When Pierre and his wife had left, he grew very quiet and began to complain of depression. A few days later, he fell ill and took to his bed. He realized from the first that he would not get up again, despite the doctor's encouragement. The countess passed a fortnight in an armchair by his pillow without undressing. Every time she gave him his medicine, he sobbed and silently kissed her hand. On his last day, sobbing, he asked her and his absent son to forgive him for having dissipated their property, that being the chief fault of which he was conscious. After receiving communion and unction, he quietly died, and next day a throng of acquaintances who came to pay their last respects to the deceased filled the house rented by the Rostovs. All these acquaintances, who had so often dined and danced at his house and had so often laughed at him, now said with a common feeling of self-reproach and emotion, as if justifying themselves, "Well, whatever he may have been, he was a most worthy man. You don't meet such men nowadays. And which of us has not weaknesses of his own?" It was just when the Count's affairs had become so involved that it was impossible to say what would happen if he lived another year, that he unexpectedly died. Nicholas was with the Russian army in Paris when the news of his father's death reached him. He at once resigned his commission and without waiting for it to be accepted, took leave of absence and went to Moscow. The state of the Count's affairs became quite obvious a month after his death, surprising everyone by the immense total of small debts, the existence of which no one had suspected. The debts amounted to double the value of the property. Friends and relations advised Nicholas to decline the inheritance, but he regarded such a refusal as a slur on his father's memory, which he held sacred, and therefore would not hear of refusing, and accepted the inheritance together with the obligation to pay the debts. The creditors, who had so long been silent, restrained by a vague but powerful influence exerted on them while he lived by the Count's careless good nature, all proceeded to enforce their claims at once. As always happens in such cases, rivalry sprang up as to which should get paid first, and those who, like Mityenka, held promissory notes given them as presents, now became the most exacting of the creditors. Nicholas was allowed no respite and no peace, and those who had seemed to pity the old man, the cause of their losses, if they were losses, now remorselessly pursued the young heir who had voluntarily undertaken the debts and was obviously not guilty of contracting them. Not one of the plans Nicholas tried succeeded. The estate was sold by auction for half its value, and half the debts still remained unpaid. Nicholas accepted 30,000 rubles offered him by his brother-in-law Bezukhov to pay off debts he regarded as genuinely due for value received. And to avoid being imprisoned for the remainder, as the creditors threatened, he re-entered the government service. He could not rejoin the army, where he would have been made colonel at the next vacancy, for his mother now clung to him as her one hold on life. And so, despite his reluctance to remain in Moscow among people who had known him before, and despite his abhorrence of the civil service, he accepted a post in Moscow in that service, doffed the uniform of which he was so fond, and moved with his mother and Sonya to a small house on the Sivtsev Vrazhok, a poor quarter of Moscow. Natasha and Pierre were living in Petersburg at the time and had no clear idea of Nicholas's circumstances. Having borrowed money from his brother-in-law, Nicholas tried to hide his wretched condition from him. His position was the more difficult because with his salary of 1,200 rubles, he had not only to keep himself, his mother, and Sonya, but had to shield his mother from knowledge of their poverty. The Countess could not conceive of life without the luxurious conditions she had been used to from childhood, and, unable to realize how hard it was for her son, kept demanding now a carriage, which they did not keep, to send for a friend, now some expensive article of food for herself, or wine for her son, or money to buy a present as a surprise for Natasha or Sonya, or for Nicholas himself. Sonya kept house, attended on her aunt, read to her, put up with her whims and secret ill will, and helped Nicholas to conceal their poverty from the old countess. Nicholas felt himself irredeemably indebted to Sonya for all she was doing for his mother, and greatly admired her patience and devotion, but tried to keep aloof from her. He seemed in his heart to reproach her for being too perfect, and because there was nothing to reproach her with. She had all that people are valued for, but little that could have made him love her. He felt that the more he valued her, the less he loved her. He had taken her at her word when she wrote giving him his freedom, and now behaved as if all that had passed between them had been long forgotten and could never in any case be renewed. Nicholas's position became worse and worse. The idea of putting something aside out of his salary proved a dream. Not only did he not save anything, but to comply with his mother's demands, he even incurred some small debts. He could see no way out of this situation. The idea of marrying some rich woman, which was suggested to him by his female relations, was repugnant to him. The other way out, his mother's death, never entered his head. He wished for nothing and hoped for nothing, and deep in his heart experienced a gloomy and stern satisfaction in an uncomplaining endurance of his position. He tried to avoid his old acquaintances with their commiseration and offensive offers of assistance. He avoided all distraction and recreation, and even at home did nothing but play cards with his mother, pace silently up and down the room, and smoke one pipe after another. He seemed carefully to cherish within himself the gloomy mood which alone enabled him to endure his position. At the beginning of winter, Princess Mary came to Moscow. From reports current in town, she learned how the Rostovs were situated and how the son has sacrificed himself for his mother, as people were saying. "I never expected anything else of him," said Princess Mary to herself, feeling a joyous sense of her love for him. Remembering her friendly relations with all the Rostovs, which had made her almost a member of the family, she thought it her duty to go to see them. But remembering her relations with Nicholas in Voronezh, she was shy about doing so. Making a great effort, she did, however, go to call on them a few weeks after her arrival in Moscow. Nicholas was the first to meet her, as the Countess's room could only be reached through his. But instead of being greeted with pleasure, as she had expected, at his first glance at her, his face assumed a cold, stiff, proud expression she had not seen on it before. He inquired about her health, led the way to his mother, and having sat there for 5 minutes, left the room. When the princess came out of the countess's room, Nicholas met her again, and with marked solemnity and stiffness accompanied her to the anteroom. To her remarks about his mother's health, he made no reply. "What's that to you? Leave me in peace," his looks seemed to say. "Why does she come prowling here? What does she want? I can't bear these ladies and all these civilities," said he aloud in Sonya's presence, evidently unable to repress his vexation after the princess's carriage had disappeared. "Oh, Nicholas, how can you talk like that?" cried Sonya, hardly able to conceal her delight. "She's so kind, and Mama so fond of her." Nicholas did not reply and tried to avoid speaking of the princess any more. But after her visit, the old countess spoke of her several times a day. She sang her praises, insisted that her son must call on her, expressed a wish to see her often, but yet always became ill-humored when she began to talk about her. Nicholas tried to keep silence when his mother spoke of the princess, but his silence irritated her. "She's a very admirable and excellent young woman," said she, "and you must go and call on her. You would at least be seeing somebody, and I think it must be dull for you, only seeing us." "But I don't in the least want to, Mama." "You used to want to, and now you don't. Really, I don't understand you, my dear. One day you're dull, and the next you refuse to see anyone." "But I never said I was dull." "Why, you said yourself you don't want even to see her. She's a very admirable young woman, and you always liked her, but now suddenly you've got some notion or other in your head. You hide everything from me." "Not at all, Mama. If I were asking you to do something disagreeable now, but I only ask you to return a call, one would think mere politeness required it. Well, I've asked you, and now I won't interfere any more, since you've secrets from your mother."
"Well, then I'll go if you wish it."
"It doesn't matter to me. I only wish it for your sake." Nicholas sighed, bit his moustache, and laid out the cards for a patience, trying to divert his mother's attention to another topic. The same conversation was repeated next day, and the day after, and the day after that. After her visit to the Rostovs and her unexpectedly chilly reception by Nicholas, Princess Mary confessed to herself that she had been right in not wishing to be the first to call. "I expected nothing else," she told herself, calling her pride to her aid. "I have nothing to do with him, and I only wanted to see the old lady, who was always kind to me and to whom I am under many obligations." But she could not pacify herself with these reflections. A feeling akin to remorse troubled her when she thought of her visit. Though she had firmly resolved not to call on the Rostovs again and to forget the whole matter, she felt herself all the time in an awkward position. And when she asked herself what distressed her, she had to admit that it was her relation to Rostov. His cold, polite manner did not express his feeling for her, she knew that, but it concealed something, and until she could discover what that something was, she felt that she could not be at ease. One day in midwinter, when sitting in the schoolroom attending to her nephew's lessons, she was informed that Rostov had called. With a firm resolution not to betray herself and not to show her agitation, she sent for Mademoiselle Bourienne and went with her to the drawing-room. Her first glance at Nicholas's face told her that he had only come to fulfill the demands of politeness, and she firmly resolved to maintain the tone in which he addressed her. They spoke of the Countess's health, of their mutual friends, of the latest war news, and when the 10 minutes required by propriety had elapsed, after which a visitor may rise, Nicholas got up to say goodbye. With Mademoiselle Bourienne's help, the princess had maintained the conversation very well, but at the very last moment, just when he rose, she was so tired of talking of what did not interest her, and her mind was so full of the question why she alone was granted so little happiness in life, that in a fit of absent-mindedness she sat still, her luminous eyes gazing fixedly before her, not noticing that he had risen. Nicholas glanced at her, and wishing to appear not to notice her abstraction, made some remark to Mademoiselle Bourienne, and then again looked at the princess. She still sat motionless with a look of suffering on her gentle face. He suddenly felt sorry for her, and was vaguely conscious that he might be the cause of the sadness her face expressed. He wished to help her and say something pleasant, but could think of nothing to say. "Goodbye, princess," said he. She started, flushed, and sighed deeply. "Oh, I beg your pardon," she said, as if waking up. "Are you going already, Count? Well, then, goodbye. Oh, but the cushion for the Countess." "Wait a moment, I'll fetch it," said Mademoiselle Bourienne, and she left the room. They both sat silent, with an occasional glance at one another.
"Yes, Princess," said Nicholas at last, with a sad smile. "It doesn't seem long ago since we first met at Boguchárovo, but how much water has flowed since then. In what distress we all seemed to be then. Yet I would give much to bring back that time. But there's no bringing it back." Princess Mary gazed intently into his eyes with her own luminous ones as he said this. She seemed to be trying to fathom the hidden meaning of his words, which would explain his feeling for her. "Yes, yes," she said, "but you have no reason to regret the past, Count. As I understand your present life, I think you will always recall it with satisfaction, because the self-sacrifice that fills it now—" "I cannot accept your praise," he interrupted her hurriedly. "On the contrary, I continually reproach myself, but this is not at all an interesting or cheerful subject." His face again resumed its former stiff and cold expression. But the princess had caught a glimpse of the man she had known and loved, and it was to him that she now spoke. "I thought you would allow me to tell you this," she said. "I had come so near to you and to all your family that I thought you would not consider my sympathy misplaced. But I was mistaken." And suddenly her voice trembled. "I don't know why," she continued, recovering herself, "but you used to be different, and there are a thousand reasons why," laying special emphasis on the why. "Thank you, Princess," he added softly. "Sometimes it is hard." "So that's why," a voice whispered in Princess Mary's soul. No, it was not only that gay, kind, and frank look, not only that handsome exterior that I loved in him. I divined his noble, resolute, self-sacrificing spirit, too," she said to herself. "Yes, he is poor now, and I am rich. Yes, that's the only reason. Yes, were it not for that." And remembering his former tenderness, and looking now at his kind, sorrowful face, she suddenly understood the cause of his coldness. "But why, Count, why?" she almost cried, unconsciously moving closer to him. "Why? Tell me, you must tell me." He was silent. "I don't understand your why, Count," she continued. "But it's hard for me, I confess it. For some reason you wish to deprive me of our former friendship. And that hurts me." There were tears in her eyes and in her voice. "I've had so little happiness in life that every loss is hard for me to bear. Excuse me, goodbye." And suddenly she began to cry, and was hurrying from the room. "Princess, for God's sake," he exclaimed, trying to stop her. "Princess!" She turned round. For a few seconds they gazed silently into one another's eyes, and what had seemed impossible and remote suddenly became possible, inevitable, and very near. In the winter of 1813, Nicholas married Princess Mary and moved to Bald Hills with his wife, his mother, and Sonia. Within 4 years, he had paid off all his remaining debts without selling any of his wife's property, and having received a small inheritance on the death of a cousin, he paid his debt to Pierre as well. In another 3 years, by 1820, he had so managed his affairs that he was able to buy a small estate adjoining Bald Hills, and was negotiating to buy back Otradnoye, that being his pet dream. Having started farming from necessity, he soon grew so devoted to it that it became his favorite and almost his sole occupation. Nicholas was a plain farmer. He did not like innovations, especially the English ones then coming into vogue. He laughed at theoretical treatises on estate management, disliked factories, the raising of expensive products, and the buying of expensive seed corn, and did not make a hobby of any particular part of the work on his estate. He always had before his mind's eye the estate as a whole, and not any particular part of it. The chief thing, in his eyes, was not the nitrogen in the soil, nor the oxygen in the air, nor manures, nor special ploughs, but that most important agent by which nitrogen, oxygen, manure, and plough were made effective, the peasant laborer. When Nicholas first began farming and began to understand its different branches, it was the serf who especially attracted his attention. The peasant seemed to him not merely a tool, but also a judge of farming and an end in himself. At first he watched the serfs, trying to understand their aims and what they considered good and bad, and only pretended to direct them and give orders, while in reality learning from them their methods, their manner of speech, and their judgment of what was good and bad. Only when he had understood the peasants' tastes and aspirations, had learned to talk their language, to grasp the hidden meaning of their words, and felt akin to them, did he begin boldly to manage his serfs, that is, to perform toward them the duties demanded of him. And Nicholas's management produced very brilliant results. Guided by some gift of insight, on taking up the management of the estates, he at once unerringly appointed as bailiff, village elder, and delegate the very men the serfs would themselves had chosen had they had the right to choose. And these posts never changed hands. Before analyzing the properties of manure, before entering into the debit and credit, as he ironically called it, he found out how many cattle the peasants had, and increased the number by all possible means. He kept the peasant families together in the largest groups possible, not allowing the family groups to divide into separate households. He was hard alike on the lazy, the depraved, and the weak, and tried to get them expelled from the commune. He was as careful of the sowing and reaping of the peasants' hay and corn as of his own, and few landowners had their crops sown and harvested so early and so well, or got so good a return as did Nicholas. He disliked having anything to do with the domestic serfs, the drones, as he called them, and everyone said he spoiled them by his laxity. When a decision had to be taken regarding a domestic serf, especially if one had to be punished, he always felt undecided and consulted everybody in the house. But when it was possible to have a domestic serf conscripted instead of a land worker, he did so without the least hesitation. He never felt any hesitation in dealing with the peasants. He knew that his every decision would be approved by them all, with very few exceptions. He did not allow himself either to be hard on or punish a man, or to make things easy for or reward anyone, merely because he felt inclined to do so. He could not have said by what standard he judged what he should or should not do, but the standard was quite firm and definite in his own mind. Often, speaking with vexation of some failure or irregularity, he would say, "What can one do with our Russian peasants?" and imagined that he could not bear them. Yet he loved our Russian peasants and their way of life with his whole soul, and for that very reason had understood and assimilated the one way and manner of farming which produced good results. Countess Mary was jealous of this passion of her husband's, and regretted that she could not share it. But she could not understand the joys and vexations he derived from that world, to her so remote and alien. She could not understand why he was so particularly animated and happy when, after getting up at daybreak and spending the whole morning in the fields or on the threshing floor, he returned from the sowing or mowing or reaping to have tea with her. She did not understand why he spoke with such admiration and delight of the farming of the thrifty and well-to-do peasant Matthew Yermishin, who with his family had carted corn all night. or of the fact that his, Nicholas's, sheaves were already stacked before anyone else had his harvest in. She did not understand why he stepped out from the window to the veranda and smiled under his moustache and winked so joyfully when warm, steady rain began to fall on the dry and thirsty shoots of the young oats, or why, when the wind carried away a threatening cloud during the hay harvest, he would return from the barn, flushed, sunburned, and perspiring, with the smell of wormwood and gentian in his hair, and gleefully rubbing his hands would say, "Well, one more day, and my grain and the peasants will be all under cover." Still less did she understand why he, kind-hearted and always ready to anticipate her wishes, should become almost desperate when she brought him a petition from some peasant men or women who had appealed to her to be excused some work. Why he, that kind Nicholas, should obstinately refuse her, angrily asking her not to interfere in what was not her business. She felt he had a world apart which he loved passionately, and which had laws she had not fathomed. Sometimes, when trying to understand him, she spoke of the good work he was doing for his serfs, he would be vexed and reply, "Not in the least, it never entered my head, and I wouldn't do that for their good. That's all poetry and old wives' talk, all that doing good to one's neighbor. What I want is that our children should not have to go begging. I must put our affairs in order while I'm alive, that's all, and to do that, order and strictness are essential." "That's all about it," said he, clenching his vigorous fist. "And fairness, of course," he added. "For if the peasant is naked and hungry and has only one miserable horse, he can do no good either for himself or for me." And all Nicholas did was fruitful, probably just because he refused to allow himself to think that he was doing good to others for virtue's sake. His means increased rapidly. Serfs from neighboring estates came to beg him to buy them, and long after his death the memory of his administration was devoutly preserved among the serfs. He was a master. The peasant's affairs first, and then his own. Of course, he was not to be trifled with either. In a word, he was a real master. One matter connected with his management sometimes worried Nicholas, and that was his quick temper, together with his old hussar habit of making free use of his fists. At first he saw nothing reprehensible in this, but in the second year of his marriage his view of that form of punishment suddenly changed. Once, in summer, he had sent for the village elder from Boguchárovo, a man who had succeeded to the post when Dron died, and who was accused of dishonesty and various irregularities. Nicholas went out into the porch to question him, and immediately after the elder had given a few replies, the sound of cries and blows was heard. On returning to lunch, Nicholas went up to his wife, who sat with her head bent low over her embroidery frame, and as usual began to tell her what he had been doing that morning. Among other things, he spoke of the Boguchárovo elder. Countess Mary turned red and then pale, but continued to sit with head bowed and lips compressed, and gave her husband no reply. "Such an insolent scoundrel!" he cried, growing hot again at the mere recollection of him. "If he had told me he was drunk and did not see... What's the matter with you, Mary?" he suddenly asked. Countess Mary raised her head and tried to speak, but hastily looked down again, and her lips puckered. "Why, whatever is the matter, my dearest?" The looks of the plain Countess Mary always improved when she was in tears. She never cried from pain or vexation, but always from sorrow or pity. And when she wept, her radiant eyes acquired an irresistible charm. The moment Nicholas took her hand, she could no longer restrain herself and began to cry.
"Nicholas, I saw it. He was to blame, but why do you... Nicholas..."
And she covered her face with her hands. Nicholas said nothing. He flushed crimson, left her side, and paced up and down the room. He understood what she was weeping about, but could not in his heart at once agree with her that what he had regarded from childhood as quite an everyday event was wrong. "Is it just sentimentality? Old wives' tales? Or is she right?" he asked himself. Before he had solved that point, he glanced again at her face, filled with love and pain, and he suddenly realized that she was right, and that he had long been sinning against himself. Mary, he said softly, going up to her, it will never happen again. I give you my word. Never, he repeated in a trembling voice, like a boy asking for forgiveness. The tears flowed faster still from the Countess's eyes. She took his hand and kissed it.
Nicholas, when did you break your cameo?
She asked to change the subject, looking at his finger on which he wore a ring with a cameo of Laocoon's head.
Today, it was the same affair. Oh, Mary, don't remind me of it.
And again he flushed. I give you my word of honor it shan't occur again. And let this always be a reminder to me. And he pointed to the broken ring. After that, when in discussions with his village elders or stewards the blood rushed to his face and his fists began to clench, Nicholas would turn the broken ring on his finger and would drop his eyes before the man who was making him angry. But he did forget himself once or twice within a twelvemonth, and then he would go and confess to his wife and would again promise that this should really be the very last time. Mary, you must despise me, he would say. I deserve it.
You should go. Go away at once if you don't feel strong enough to control yourself, she would reply sadly, trying to comfort her husband.
Among the gentry of the province, Nicholas was respected but not liked. He did not concern himself with the interests of his own class, and consequently some thought him proud and others thought him stupid. The whole summer, from spring sowing to harvest, he was busy with the work on his farm. In autumn, he gave himself up to hunting with the same business-like seriousness, leaving home for a month or even two with his hunt. In winter, he visited his other villages or spent his time reading. The books he read were chiefly historical, and on these he spent a certain sum every year. He was collecting, as he said, a serious library, and he made it a rule to read through all the books he bought. He would sit in his study with a grave air, reading, a task he first imposed upon himself as a duty, but which afterwards became a habit, affording him a special kind of pleasure, and a consciousness of being occupied with serious matters. In winter, except for business excursions, he spent most of his time at home, making himself one with his family, and entering into all the details of his children's relations with their mother. The harmony between him and his wife grew closer and closer, and he daily discovered fresh spiritual treasures in her. From the time of his marriage, Sonia had lived in his house. Before that, Nicholas had told his wife all that had passed between himself and Sonia, blaming himself and commending her. He had asked Princess Mary to be gentle and kind to his cousin. She thoroughly realized the wrong he had done Sonia, felt herself to blame toward her, and imagined that her wealth had influenced Nicholas's choice. She could not find fault with Sonia in any way and tried to be fond of her, but often felt ill-will toward her, which she could not overcome. Once she had a talk with her friend Natasha about Sonia and about her own injustice toward her. "You know," said Natasha, "you've read the Gospels a great deal. There is a passage in them that just fits Sonia."
"What?"
asked Countess Mary, surprised. "To him that hath shall be given, and from him that hath not shall be taken away. You remember? She is one that hath not. Why, I don't know. Perhaps she lacks egotism, I don't know, but from her is taken away, and everything has been taken away. Sometimes I'm dreadfully sorry for her. Formerly, I very much wanted Nicholas to marry her, but I always had a sort of presentiment that it would not come off. She is a sterile flower, you know, like some strawberry blossoms. Sometimes I'm sorry for her, and sometimes I think she doesn't feel it, as you or I would." Though Countess Mary told Natasha that those words in the Gospel must be understood differently, yet, looking at Sonia, she agreed with Natasha's explanation. It really seemed that Sonia did not feel her position trying, and had grown quite reconciled to her lot as a sterile flower. She seemed to be fond not so much of individuals as of the family as a whole. Like a cat, she had attached herself not to the people, but to the home. She waited on the old countess, petted and spoiled the children, was always ready to render the small services for which she had a gift, and all this was unconsciously accepted from her with insufficient gratitude. The country seat at Bald Hills had been rebuilt, though not on the same scale as under the old prince. The buildings, begun under straitened circumstances, were more than simple. The immense house on the old stone foundations was of wood, plastered only inside. It had bare deal floors, and was furnished with very simple hard sofas, armchairs, tables, and chairs made by their own serf carpenters out of their own birchwood. The house was spacious, and had rooms for the house serfs, and apartments for visitors. Whole families of the Rostovs and Bolkonskis' relations sometimes came to Bald Hills with 16 horses and dozens of servants and stayed for months. Besides that, 4 times a year, on the name days and birthdays of the hosts, as many as 100 visitors would gather there for a day or two. The rest of the year, life pursued its unbroken routine, with its ordinary occupations and its breakfasts, lunches, dinners, and suppers, provided out of the produce of the estate. It was the eve of St. Nicholas, the 5th of December, 1820. Natasha had been staying at her brother's with her husband and children since early autumn. Pierre had gone to Petersburg on business of his own for 3 weeks, as he said, but had remained there nearly 7 weeks and was expected back every minute. Besides the Bezukhov family, Nicholas's old friend, the retired General Vasily Dmitrich Denisov, was staying with the Rostovs this 5th of December. On the 6th, which was his name day, when the house would be full of visitors, Nicholas knew he would have to exchange his Tartar tunic for a tailcoat and put on narrow boots with pointed toes and drive to the new church he had built, and then receive visitors who would come to congratulate him, offer them refreshments, and talk about the elections of the nobility. But he considered himself entitled to spend the eve of that day in his usual way. He examined the bailiff's accounts of the village in Ryazan, which belonged to his wife's nephew, wrote 2 business letters, and walked over to the granaries, cattle yards, and stables before dinner. Having taken precautions against the general drunkenness to be expected on the morrow, because it was a great saint's day, he returned to dinner, and without having time for a private talk with his wife, sat down at the long table laid for 20 persons, at which the whole household had assembled. At that table were his mother, his mother's old lady companion Bielova, his wife, their 3 children with their governess and tutor, his wife's nephew with his tutor, Sonya, Denisov, Natasha, her 3 children, their governess, and old Michael Ivanovich, the late prince's architect who was living on in retirement at Bald Hills. Countess Mary sat at the other end of the table. When her husband took his place, she concluded, from the rapid manner in which, after taking up his table napkin, he pushed back the tumbler and wine glass standing before him, that he was out of humor, as was sometimes the case when he came in to dinner straight from the farm, especially before the soup. Countess Mary well knew that mood of his, and when she herself was in a good frame of mind, quietly waited till he had had his soup, and then began to talk to him, and make him admit that there was no cause for his ill-humor. But today she quite forgot that, and was hurt that he should be angry with her without any reason, and she felt unhappy. She asked him where he had been. He replied. She again inquired whether everything was going well on the farm. Her unnatural tone made him wince unpleasantly, and he replied hastily. "Then I'm not mistaken," thought Countess Mary. "Why is he cross with me?" She concluded from his tone that he was vexed with her and wished to end the conversation. She knew her remark sounded unnatural, but could not refrain from asking some more questions. Thanks to Denisov, the conversation at table soon became general and lively, and she did not talk to her husband. When they left the table and went, as usual, to thank the old countess, note, it was customary in Russia to thank the hostess after dinner, and in this case the old countess, though she was not the hostess, was thanked out of deference. Countess Mary held out her hand and kissed her husband and asked him why he was angry with her. "You always have such strange fancies. I didn't even think of being angry," he replied. But the word always seemed to her to imply, "Yes, I am angry, but I won't tell you why." Nicholas and his wife lived together so happily that even Sonya and the old countess, who felt jealous and would have liked them to disagree, could find nothing to reproach them with. But even they had their moments of antagonism. Occasionally, and it was always just after they had been happiest together, they suddenly had a feeling of estrangement and hostility, which occurred most frequently during Countess Mary's pregnancies, and this was such a time. "Well, messieurs et mesdames," said Nicholas loudly and with apparent cheerfulness. It seemed to Countess Mary that he did it on purpose to vex her. "I've been on my feet since 6 this morning. Tomorrow I shall have to suffer, so today I'll go and rest." And without a word to his wife, he went to the little sitting room and lay down on the sofa. "That's always the way," thought Countess Mary. "He talks to everyone except me. I see that I'm repulsive to him, especially when I'm in this condition." She looked down at her expanded figure, and in the glass at her pale, sallow, emaciated face, in which her eyes now looked larger than ever. And everything annoyed her. Denisov's shouting and laughter, Natasha's talk, and especially a quick glance Sonya gave her. Sonya was always the first excuse Countess Mary found for feeling irritated. Having sat a while with her visitors without understanding anything of what they were saying, she softly left the room and went to the nursery. The children were playing at going to Moscow in a carriage made of chairs, and invited her to go with them. She sat down and played with them a little, but the thought of her husband and his unreasonable crossness worried her. She got up and, walking on tiptoe with difficulty, went to the small sitting room. "Perhaps he's not asleep. I'll have an explanation with him," she said to herself. Little Andrew, her eldest boy, imitating his mother, followed her on tiptoe. She did not notice him. "Mary, dear, I think he's asleep. He was so tired," said Sonya, meeting her in the large sitting room. It seemed to Countess Mary that she crossed her path everywhere. "Andrew may wake him." Countess Mary looked round, saw little Andrew following her, felt that Sonya was right, and for that very reason flushed, and with evident difficulty refrained from saying something harsh. She made no reply, but to avoid obeying Sonya, beckoned to Andrew to follow her quietly, and went to the door. Sonya went away by another door. From the room in which Nicholas was sleeping came the sound of his even breathing, every slightest tone of which was familiar to his wife. As she listened to it, she saw before her his smooth, handsome forehead, his moustache, and his whole face, as she had so often seen it in the stillness of the night when he slept. Nicholas suddenly moved and cleared his throat. And at that moment, little Andrew shouted from outside the door, "Papa! Mama's standing here!" Countess Mary turned pale with fright and made signs to the boy. He grew silent, and quiet ensued for a moment, terrible to Countess Mary. She knew how Nicholas disliked being waked. Then through the door she heard Nicholas clearing his throat again and stirring, and his voice said crossly, "I can't get a moment's peace. Mary, is that you? Why did you bring him here?"
"I only came in to look and did not notice. Forgive me."
Nicholas coughed and said no more. Countess Mary moved away from the door and took the boy back to the nursery. 5 minutes later, little black-eyed 3-year-old Natasha, her father's pet, having learned from her brother that Papa was asleep and Mama was in the sitting room, ran to her father, unobserved by her mother. The dark-eyed little girl boldly opened the creaking door, went up to the sofa with energetic steps of her sturdy little legs, and having examined the position of her father, who was asleep with his back to her, rose on tiptoe and kissed the hand which lay under his head. Nicholas turned with a tender smile on his face.
"Natasha! Natasha!" came Countess Mary's frightened whisper from the door. "Papa wants to sleep."
"No, Mama, he doesn't want to sleep," said little Natasha with conviction. "He's laughing."
Nicholas lowered his legs, rose, and took his daughter in his arms. "Come in, Mary," he said to his wife. She went in and sat down by her husband.
"I did not notice him following me," she said timidly. "I just looked in."
Holding his little girl with one arm, Nicholas glanced at his wife, and, seeing her guilty expression, put his other arm around her and kissed her hair.
"May I kiss Mama?" he asked Natasha.
Natasha smiled bashfully.
"Again," she commanded, pointing with a peremptory gesture to the spot where Nicholas had placed the kiss.
"I don't know why you think I'm cross," said Nicholas, replying to the question he knew was in his wife's mind. "You have no idea how unhappy, how lonely I feel when you're like that. It always seems to me—"
"Mary, don't talk nonsense. You ought to be ashamed of yourself,"
he said gaily. "It seems to me that you can't love me, that I'm so plain always, and now, in this con—"
"Oh, how absurd you are!
It's not beauty that endears. It's love that makes us see beauty. It is only Malvinas and women of that kind who are loved for their beauty. But do I love my wife? I don't love her, but I don't know how to put it. Without you, or when something comes between us like this, I seem lost and can't do anything. Now, do I love my finger? I don't love it, but just try to cut it off. I'm not like that myself, but I understand. So you're not angry with me?"
"Awfully angry," he said, smiling and getting up. And smoothing his hair, he began to pace the room.
"Do you know, Mary, what I've been thinking?" he began, immediately thinking aloud in his wife's presence, now that they had made it up. He did not ask if she was ready to listen to him. He did not care. A thought had occurred to him, and so it belonged to her also. And he told her of his intention to persuade Pierre to stay with them till spring. Countess Mary listened till he had finished, made some remark, and in her turn began thinking aloud. Her thoughts were about the children. "You can see the woman in her already," she said in French, pointing to little Natasha. "You reproach us women with being illogical. Here is our logic. I say, Papa wants to sleep, but she says, no, he's laughing. And she was right," said Countess Mary with a happy smile.
"Yes, yes."
And Nicholas, taking his little daughter in his strong hand, lifted her high, placed her on his shoulder, held her by the legs, and paced the room with her. There was an expression of carefree happiness on the faces of both father and daughter.
"But, you know, you may be unfair. You're too fond of this one," his wife whispered in French.
"Yes, but what am I to do? I try not to show."
At that moment they heard the sound of the door pulley and footsteps in the hall and anteroom, as if someone had arrived. "Somebody's come."
"I'm sure it is Pierre. I will go and see," said Countess Mary, and left the room.
In her absence, Nicholas allowed himself to give his little daughter a gallop round the room. Out of breath, he took the laughing child quickly from his shoulder and pressed her to his heart. His capers reminded him of dancing, and looking at the child's round, happy little face, he thought of what she would be like when he was an old man, taking her into society and dancing the mazurka with her, as his old father had danced Daniel Cooper with his daughter.
"It is he! It is he, Nicholas!" said Countess Mary, re-entering the room a few minutes later. "Now our Natasha has come to life. You should have seen her ecstasy, and how he caught it for having stayed away so long. Well, come along now, quick, quick. It's time you two were parted," she added, looking smilingly at the little girl who clung to her father.
Nicholas went out, holding the child by the hand. Countess Mary remained in the sitting room.
"I should never, never have believed that one could be so happy," she whispered to herself. A smile lit up her face, but at the same time she sighed, and her deep eyes expressed a quiet sadness, as though she felt through her happiness that there is another sort of happiness unattainable in this life, and of which she involuntarily thought at that instant.
Chapter 3. Natasha's and Pierre's family life. His return after a visit to Petersburg. The old countess in decay. Conversation about social tendencies and indignation at reactionary trend of the government. Views of Pierre and Nicholas. Natasha had married in the early spring of 1813, and in 1820 already had three daughters, besides a son for whom she had longed and whom she was now nursing. She had grown stouter and broader, so that it was difficult to recognize in this robust, motherly woman the slim, lively Natasha of former days. Her features were more defined, and had a calm, soft, and serene expression. In her face there was none of the ever-glowing animation that had formerly burned there and constituted its charm. Now her face and body were often all that one saw, and her soul was not visible at all. All that struck the eye was a strong, handsome, and fertile woman. The old fire very rarely kindled in her face now. That happened only when, as was the case that day, her husband returned home, or a sick child was convalescent, or when she and Countess Mary spoke of Prince Andrew. She never mentioned him to her husband, who she imagined was jealous of Prince Andrew's memory. Or on the rare occasions when something happened to induce her to sing, a practice she had quite abandoned since her marriage. At the rare moments when the old fire did kindle in her handsome, fully developed body, she was even more attractive than in former days. Since their marriage, Natasha and her husband had lived in Moscow, in Petersburg, on their estate near Moscow, or with her mother, that is to say, in Nicholas's house. The young Countess Bezukhova was not often seen in society, and those who met her there were not pleased with her and found her neither attractive nor amiable. Not that Natasha liked solitude. She did not know whether she liked it or not. She even thought that she did not. But with her pregnancies, her confinements, the nursing of her children, and sharing every moment of her husband's life, she had demands on her time which could be satisfied only by renouncing society. All who had known Natasha before her marriage wondered at the change in her as at something extraordinary. Only the old countess, with her maternal instinct, had realized that all Natasha's outbursts had been due to her need of children and a husband, as she herself had once exclaimed at Otrádnoye, not so much in fun as in earnest, and her mother was now surprised at the surprise expressed by those who had never understood Natasha, and she kept saying that she had always known that Natasha would make an exemplary wife and mother. "Only she lets her love of her husband and children overflow all bounds," said the countess, "so that it even becomes absurd." Natasha did not follow the golden rule advocated by clever folk, especially by the French, which says that a girl should not let herself go when she marries, should not neglect her accomplishments, should be even more careful of her appearance than when she was unmarried, and should fascinate her husband as much as she did before he became her husband. Natasha, on the contrary, had at once abandoned all her witchery, of which her singing had been an unusually powerful part. She gave it up just because it was so powerfully seductive. She took no pains with her manners, or with delicacy of speech, or with her toilet, or to show herself to her husband in her most becoming attitudes, or to avoid inconveniencing him by being too exacting. She acted in contradiction to all those rules. She felt that the allurements instinct had formerly taught her to use would now be merely ridiculous in the eyes of her husband, to whom she had from the first moment given herself up entirely, that is, with her whole soul, leaving no corner of it hidden from him. She felt that her unity with her husband was not maintained by the poetic feelings that had attracted him to her, but by something else, indefinite, but firm as the bond between her own body and soul. To fluff out her curls, put on fashionable dresses, and sing romantic songs to fascinate her husband would have seemed as strange as to adorn herself to attract herself. To adorn herself for others might perhaps have been agreeable, she did not know, but she had no time at all for it. The chief reason for devoting no time either to singing, to dress, or to choosing her words was that she really had no time to spare for these things. We know that man has the faculty of becoming completely absorbed in a subject, however trivial it may be, and that there is no subject so trivial that it will not grow to infinite proportions if one's entire attention is devoted to it. The subject which wholly engrossed Natasha's attention was her family, that is, her husband, whom she had to keep so that he should belong entirely to her and to the home, and the children whom she had to bear, bring into the world, nurse, and bring up. And the deeper she penetrated, not with her mind only, but with her whole soul, her whole being, into the subject that absorbed her, the larger did that subject grow, and the weaker and more inadequate did her own powers appear, so that she concentrated them wholly on that one thing, and yet was unable to accomplish all that she considered necessary. There were then, as now, conversations and discussions about women's rights, the relations of husband and wife and their freedom and rights, though these themes were not yet termed questions as they are now. But these topics were not merely uninteresting to Natasha, she positively did not understand them. These questions, then as now, existed only for those who see nothing in marriage but the pleasure married people get from one another, that is, only the beginnings of marriage and not its whole significance, which lies in the family. Discussions and questions of that kind, which are like the question of how to get the greatest gratification from one's dinner, did not then and do not now exist for those for whom the purpose of a dinner is the nourishment it affords, and the purpose of marriage is the family. If the purpose of dinner is to nourish the body, a man who eats two dinners at once may perhaps get more enjoyment, but will not attain his purpose, for his stomach will not digest the two dinners. If the purpose of marriage is the family, the person who wishes to have many wives or husbands may perhaps obtain much pleasure, but in that case will not have a family. If the purpose of food is nourishment, and the purpose of marriage is the family, the whole question resolves itself into not eating more than one can digest, and not having more wives or husbands than are needed for the family, that is, one wife or one husband. Natasha needed a husband. A husband was given to her, and he gave her a family. And she not only saw no need of any other or better husband, but as all the powers of her soul were intent on serving that husband and family, she could not imagine and saw no interest in imagining how it would be if things were different. Natasha did not care for society in general, but prized the more the society of her relatives, Countess Mary and her brother, her mother, and Sonya. She valued the company of those to whom she could come striding disheveled from the nursery in her dressing gown and with joyful face show a yellow instead of a green stain on baby's napkin, and from whom she could hear reassuring words to the effect that baby was much better. To such an extent had Natasha let herself go that the way she dressed and did her hair, her ill-chosen words, and her jealousy — she was jealous of Sonya, of the governess, and of every woman, pretty or plain — were habitual subjects of jest to those about her. The general opinion was that Pierre was under his wife's thumb, which was really true. From the very first days of their married life, Natasha had announced her demands. Pierre was greatly surprised by his wife's view, to him a perfectly novel one, that every moment of his life belonged to her and to the family. His wife's demands astonished him, but they also flattered him, and he submitted to them. Pierre's subjection consisted in the fact that he not only dared not flirt with, but dared not even speak smilingly to any other woman, did not dare dine at the club as a pastime, did not dare spend money on a whim, and did not dare absent himself for any length of time except on business, in which his wife included his intellectual pursuits, which she did not in the least understand, but to which she attributed great importance. To make up for this, at home Pierre had the right to regulate his life and that of the whole family exactly as he chose. At home, Natasha placed herself in the position of a slave to her husband, and the whole household went on tiptoe when he was occupied, that is, was reading or writing in his study. Pierre had but to show a partiality for anything to get just what he liked done always. He had only to express a wish, and Natasha would jump up and run to fulfill it. The entire household was governed according to Pierre's supposed orders, that is, by his wishes, which Natasha tried to guess. Their way of life and place of residence, their acquaintances and ties, Natasha's occupations, the children's upbringing, were all selected not merely with regard to Pierre's expressed wishes, but to what Natasha, from the thoughts he expressed in conversation, supposed his wishes to be. And she deduced the essentials of his wishes quite correctly, and having once arrived at them, clung to them tenaciously. When Pierre himself wanted to change his mind, she would fight him with his own weapons. Thus, in a time of trouble ever memorable to him, after the birth of their first child, who was delicate, when they had to change the wet nurse 3 times and Natasha fell ill from despair, Pierre one day told her of Rousseau's view, with which he quite agreed, that to have a wet nurse is unnatural and harmful. When her next baby was born, despite the opposition of her mother, the doctors, and even of her husband himself, who were all vigorously opposed to her nursing her baby herself, a thing then unheard of and considered injurious, she insisted on having her own way, and after that nursed all her babies herself. It very often happened that in a moment of irritation husband and wife would have a dispute, but long afterwards Pierre, to his surprise and delight, would find in his wife's ideas and actions the very thought against which she had argued, but divested of everything superfluous that in the excitement of the dispute he had added when expressing his opinion. After 7 years of marriage, Pierre had the joyous and firm consciousness that he was not a bad man, and he felt this because he saw himself reflected in his wife. He felt the good and bad within himself inextricably mingled and overlapping. But only what was really good in him was reflected in his wife. All that was not quite good was rejected. And this was not the result of logical reasoning, but was a direct and mysterious reflection. 2 months previously, when Pierre was already staying with the Rostovs, he had received a letter from Prince Theodore asking him to come to Petersburg to confer on some important questions that were being discussed there by a society of which Pierre was one of the principal founders. On reading that letter, she always read her husband's letters, Natasha herself suggested that he should go to Petersburg, though she would feel his absence very acutely. She attributed immense importance to all her husband's intellectual and abstract interests, though she did not understand them, and she always dreaded being a hindrance to him in such matters. To Pierre's timid look of inquiry after reading the letter, she replied by asking him to go, but to fix a definite date for his return. He was given 4 weeks' leave of absence. Ever since that leave of absence had expired more than a fortnight before, Natasha had been in a constant state of alarm, depression, and irritability. Denisov, now a general on the retired list and much dissatisfied with the present state of affairs, had arrived during that fortnight. He looked at Natasha with sorrow and surprise, as at a bad likeness of a person once dear. A dull, dejected look, random replies, and talk about the nursery was all he saw and heard from his former enchantress. Natasha was sad and irritable all that time, especially when her mother, her brother, Sonia, or Countess Mary, in their efforts to console her, tried to excuse Pierre and suggested reasons for his delay in returning. "It's all nonsense, all rubbish, those discussions which lead to nothing in all those idiotic societies," Natasha declared, of the very affairs and the immense importance of which she firmly believed. And she would go to the nursery to nurse Petya, her only boy. No one else could tell her anything so comforting or so reasonable as this little 3-month-old creature when he lay at her breast and she was conscious of the movement of his lips and the snuffling of his little nose. That creature said, "You are angry, you are jealous, you would like to pay him out, you are afraid. But here am I, and I am he." And that was unanswerable. It was more than true. During that fortnight of anxiety, Natasha resorted to the baby for comfort so often and fussed over him so much that she overfed him and he fell ill. She was terrified by his illness, and yet that was just what she needed. While attending to him, she bore the anxiety about her husband more easily. She was nursing her boy when the sound of Pierre's sleigh was heard at the front door, and the old nurse, knowing how to please her mistress, entered the room inaudibly but hurriedly and with a beaming face. "Has he come?" Natasha asked quickly in a whisper, afraid to move lest she should rouse the dozing baby. "He's come, ma'am," whispered the nurse. The blood rushed to Natasha's face, and her feet involuntarily moved, but she could not jump up and run out. The baby again opened his eyes and looked at her. "You're here?" he seemed to be saying, and again lazily smacked his lips. Cautiously withdrawing her breast, Natasha rocked him a little, handed him to the nurse, and went with rapid steps toward the door. But at the door she stopped, as if her conscience reproached her for having in her joy left the child too soon, and she glanced round. The nurse, with raised elbows, was lifting the infant over the rail of his cot. "Go, ma'am. Don't worry, go," she whispered, smiling, with the kind of familiarity that grows up between a nurse and her mistress. Natasha ran with light footsteps to the anteroom. Denisov, who had come out of the study into the dancing room with his pipe, now for the first time recognized the old Natasha. A flood of brilliant, joyful light poured from her transfigured face. "He's come!" she exclaimed as she ran past, and Denisov felt that he too was delighted that Pierre, whom he did not much care for, had returned. On reaching the vestibule, Natasha saw a tall figure in a fur coat unwinding his scarf. "It's he, it's really he, he has come," she said to herself, and rushing at him, embraced him, pressed his head to her breast, and then pushed him back and gazed at his ruddy, happy face, covered with hoarfrost. "Yes, it is he, happy and contented." Then all at once she remembered the tortures of suspense she had experienced for the last fortnight, and the joy that had lit up her face vanished. She frowned and overwhelmed Pierre with a torrent of reproaches and angry words. "Yes, it's all very well for you. You're pleased. You've had a good time. But what about me? You might at least have shown consideration for the children. I'm nursing, and my milk was spoiled. Petya was at death's door. But you were enjoying yourself." "Yes, enjoying." Pierre knew he was not to blame, for he could not have come sooner. He knew this outburst was unseemly and would blow over in a minute or two. Above all, he knew that he himself was bright and happy. He wanted to smile, but dared not even think of doing so. He made a piteous, frightened face and bent down. "I could not, on my honor. But how is Petya?" "All right now. Come along. I wonder you're not ashamed. If only you could see what I was like without you, how I suffered." "You're well?" "Come, come," she said, not letting go of his arm, and they went to their rooms. When Nicholas and his wife came to look for Pierre, he was in the nursery holding his baby son, who was again awake, on his huge right palm, and dandling him. A blissful, bright smile was fixed on the baby's broad face with its toothless, open mouth. The storm was long since over, and there was bright, joyous sunshine on Natasha's face as she gazed tenderly at her husband and child. "And have you talked everything well over with Prince Theodore?" she asked. "Yes, capitally." "You see, he holds it up." She meant the baby's head. "But how he did frighten me. You've seen the princess? Is it true she's in love with that?"
"Yes, just fancy."
At that moment, Nicholas and Countess Mary came in. Pierre, with the baby on his hand, stooped, kissed them, and replied to their inquiries. But in spite of much that was interesting and had to be discussed, the baby with a little cap on its unsteady head evidently absorbed all his attention. "How sweet," said Countess Mary, looking at and playing with the baby. "Now, Nicholas," she added, turning to her husband, "I can't understand how it is you don't see the charm of these delicious marvels."
"I don't and can't," replied Nicholas, looking coldly at the baby. "A lump of flesh. Come along, Pierre."
"And yet he's such an affectionate father," Countess Mary said, vindicating her husband. "But only after they're a year old or so." "Now, Pierre nurses them splendidly," said Natasha. "He says his hand is just made for a baby's seat. Just look." "Only not for this," Pierre suddenly exclaimed with a laugh, and shifting the baby, he gave him to the nurse. As in every large household, there were at Bald Hill several perfectly distinct worlds which merged into one harmonious whole, though each retained its own peculiarities and made concessions to the others. Every event, joyful or sad, that took place in that house was important to all these worlds, but each had its own special reasons to rejoice or grieve over that occurrence independently of the others. For instance, Pierre's return was a joyful and important event, and they all felt it to be so. The servants, the most reliable judges of their masters, because they judge not by their conversation or expressions of feeling, but by their acts and way of life, the servants were glad of Pierre's return because they knew that when he was there, Count Nicholas would cease going every day to attend to the estate, and would be in better spirits and temper, and also because they would all receive handsome presents for the holidays. The children and their governesses were glad of Pierre's return because no one else drew them into the social life of the household as he did. He alone could play on the clavichord that Écossaise, his only piece, to which, as he said, all possible dances could be danced, and they felt sure he had brought presents for them all.
Young Nicholas, now a slim lad of 15, delicate and intelligent, with curly light brown hair and beautiful eyes, was delighted at Pierre's arrival because Uncle Pierre, as he called him, was the object of his rapturous and passionate affection. No one had instilled into him this love for Pierre, whom he saw only occasionally. Countess Mary, who had brought him up, had done her utmost to make him love her husband as she loved him, and little Nicholas did love his uncle, but loved him with just a shade of contempt. Pierre, however, he adored. He did not want to be an hussar or a knight of St. George like his uncle Nicholas. He wanted to be learned, wise, and kind like Pierre. In Pierre's presence, his face always shone with pleasure, and he flushed and was breathless when Pierre spoke to him. He did not miss a single word he uttered, and would afterwards, with de Sales or by himself, recall and reconsider the meaning of everything Pierre had said. Pierre's past life, and his unhappiness prior to 1812, of which young Nicholas had formed a vague poetic picture from some words he had overheard, his adventures in Moscow, his captivity, Platon Karatayev, of whom he had heard from Pierre, his love for Natasha, of whom the lad was also particularly fond, and especially Pierre's friendship with the father whom Nicholas could not remember, all this made Pierre in his eyes a hero and a saint. From broken remarks about Natasha and his father, from the emotion with which Pierre spoke of that dead father, and from the careful, reverent tenderness with which Natasha spoke of him, the boy, who was only just beginning to guess what love is, derived the notion that his father had loved Natasha, and when dying, had left her to his friend. But the father whom the boy did not remember appeared to him a divinity who could not be pictured, and of whom he never thought without a swelling heart and tears of sadness and rapture. So the boy also was happy that Pierre had arrived.